Okay, great. Welcome to this PLC. We do these every 2 weeks. We have cycles. We're on about the 199th call that we've done. We take about 30 minutes, and we just talk about current events. We have themes that we do, and we have discussions from some of our grantees who have done a great job. Someone just joined. Did someone join recently? Okay. Well, people may be coming in here. So we do these on a regular basis, and we talked about whatever the current issues are, and then we have guest presentations. Today we're going to have Susan L. Almano from Merrimack Valley WIB, and we're talking about WIBs. The theme we're on in this cycle is sustainability models. I call them sustainability models. They are ways that you may be able to enhance your program, the way you organize your program or who your partners are may make it a lot easier to not only sustain your program but to bring good services to your members. And there are about four, if you take our 50 grantees across the country, there are about four of these models the first one that we started talking about was entrepreneurship, and that was Recycle Force and Coalfields Development. And these were examples of two grantees that have used entrepreneurship. Recycle Force in particular has a for-profit and a non-profit, and they use the for-profit to help support the non-profit in terms of what I would call a sustainability model to enhance and leverage their program. Coalfields does the same thing. They have a non-profit, but they've got six different organizations that they bring their members in. And what's typical of this type of model is that you get employed by the for-profit or the entrepreneurial organization, and then if you have the interest, you get into the environmental workforce training, and you get the training, and then you get the benefit of working at the same time to help support yourself. And then you may go out into a different industry, or you may go back out, in the case of Recycle Force, after getting your environmental training, you may get a higher position within the recycling firm. So this was the first model we looked at this last month. Now we're going to move into a second approach, which is working with a governmental organization, which is completely different, rather than having this entrepreneurial model. The second model is use a governmental organization, and there's some tremendous, we'll be talking about today, some tremendous advantages of using, for example, a WIB, a Workforce Investment Board, and applying directly from the Workforce Investment Board and getting the Environment Workforce Development Job Training Grant through the board. And those are done different ways, and we'll probably be talking about some of those ways today because of Tacoma does it a little different than Merrimack Valley, but that's another way of getting tremendous leverage and sustainability by going directly through the government agencies. And states and WIBs can apply direct for these grants. The next thing we're going to talk about a little later will be the joining of forces. For example, taking the Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Program of EPA and maybe placing it beside. Now, you're not allowed to duplicate activities with federal grants, but you might have a youth build program through the Department of Labor that's doing construction training, and they have funding to do construction training. Well, what you do is you put them next to each other, and you use the synergies of both, and you can even use the youth build, for example, to do some screening and move those motivated that want to work in environment and bring them through the EPA program. So then now they have the skills of construction, and then some of them go into the environmental field. So that's the third kind of model you have. And then the fourth one is basically philanthropic and working with existing organizations. Actually, a goodwill model, for example, we do have grantees that are goodwill. They may leverage or partner with goodwill. And we also have grantees that are working purely on being backstopped by philanthropic purposes from companies. So we've got, it's interesting, out of these 50 grantees that are currently active, we've got them using four different methods of sustaining themselves and being able to offer more and more activities. So, well, that's the overlying tone I wanted to present before we get started. And is Susan on the line yet?
Yes, I am on the line.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, Susan, we're going to just have Heather give us a little bit of introduction of what's happening in Washington, and then we're going to get a chance to talk to Susan. So, Heather, anything new from Washington?
So, HQ didn't have any real specific news for anything that's on the job training field, but they did want to let you know that there is the RFP for the fiscal year 19 multipurpose assessment and cleanup funding. They're slated to be announced this fall. So if you're interested in learning more about them, you should subscribe to the EPA's listserv, the listserv that they have out and available. Otherwise, we'll just pass along information as we get them as well.
Okay. To give those of you who are new an overview of what's happening this year with the job training grants, give you a real broad overview, we've got we call them ARC grants. These are the people who are doing assessment, revolving loan funds, cleanup, underground storage tanks. These are the boots on the ground people, and they apply to EPA for grants similar to ours, but they're doing the cleanup work. Then you have the Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training, and we're the people who actually, we train people, give them certifications so they could work on the ARC grants. So we have these two different types of grants. They call them ARC, and we're Environmental Workforce Development Job Training. They're sister programs. We coordinate with them, but they are different, and they're done at different times. They, of course, give away a lot more money. Probably it's 10-1. On what our grants are, but we have these two programs. Now, on our program, the Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Program, what's happening is when they did the budget deal, the omnibus budget deal, they decided rather than have our next RFP in November, like the ARC people are doing, they're going to push us into the beginning of next year. So our RFPs, requests for proposals, will be coming out probably in January, February, that time frame. They will give you 60 days to do your proposal, and then they'll do their evaluation in the spring, and then the money will actually start to flow in the next fiscal year, in next October. And we periodically put this into the notes. And for those of you who may have gotten an announcement, but if you don't get notes, Heather, could you give your email address?
Absolutely. It is hkballou@eicc.edu. Again, that's hkballou@eicc.edu.
Okay. You may have gotten, we have two listservs, one big one, and then one for just PLC participants. We have about 480 PLC participants. The other list is much bigger. So it could be that you got this, you probably got the notice twice if you're on the list, but if you don't get the notes, just drop your contact information to her, refer it to her.
Before we get too much farther, Bruce is going to say one real quick for news from HMTRI.
Excellent.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Diamond. Just wanted to let you know, heads up, we're going to do another solicitation for the Certified Employee Finder. It'll probably go out on Monday. And what we're looking for primarily is information about the certifications you offer, the type of training courses that you offer, soft skills, and so forth. I'm also going to be looking for graduation, recent graduation dates, number of graduates, and prospective projected graduation dates and projected number of graduates. We'll also be asking for, the standard organization information, name, address, your website, most recent year that you received EPA funding, and, of course, contact information. So once again, that certified employee finder will be sending that solicitation out on Monday. Just wanted to give you a heads up. Thanks.
It's really a great, and I'll tell you why it's so important. We call it the employee finder because it goes to employers who are looking for people with these certs around the country. Many of them are national. You've got Arrow and many of them, they may have local branches, but they may have jobs in your community. So when they can take the list, they could say, well, we've got a big project in Oklahoma. Where is the closest training program where I can get some certified people who have confined space or they have HAZWOPR? Usually after every hurricane and a fire and spill, they're looking for all sorts of people with HAZWOPR. And this was very valuable when Katrina came around, especially. They were combing the country for anyone who had HAZWOPR. Many of our participants hadn't even finished the program yet, but they had the HAZWOPR, and they were saying, come on down, we'll put you up, we'll pay you. And some of our programs had to kind of put on hold, and some had early graduations. People in California, for example, had to have early graduation for that reason. So what the employee finder does is it broadcasts your program across the country and what certs that you're offering, a little bit about your contact information so people could contact you. There's a second reason why this little project works really well, and I use it all the time. If you want to find out, for example, what is OAI strong in, what kind of certs do they offer? Well, it's right there. It'll give out the certs they offer and the courses that they provide. If you're someone who's new and just thinking of starting a program, you're going to do your needs assessment and everything else. But you might be curious, for example, to see what Merrimack Valley is teaching and what they're doing in their community, which may be near yours. So there's a lot of benefits. And so if you contribute a little bit, you'll get a lot back. You'll get the results of everybody else. So we do this every year or so, and Bruce heads that up. Thanks, Bruce, for the heads up. Well, today we're going to have, I've always thought this is a special program, Merrimack Valley. We, as I just discussed earlier, we have these four different types of models, everything from entrepreneurial models to go-it-alone programs. And we're talking about this now because as we get closer to the RFP, we'll be talking about the nuts and bolts and get into the weeds of doing labor market assessments and how to hire and how to screen and all that. We'll be doing the technical things on that. But we're at a point now where we want to think about who should our partners be, maybe even how should we organize. If we are a WIB, do we have a chance? Is it something we should go into? Are many people doing it? How are they doing it? And these are the, even before you get started, the general questions you have to ask yourself. How do we want to partner? How do we want to organize? And, of course, Merrimack Valley is a winner. Their first grant, actually they tried one, I think before Susan was there, it was in 2004. They was one of our early programs. But then in 2011, I would say they got serious about it. They had a grant in 2011, and then every year, every 2 years after that, 13, 15, 17, they competed on the level playing field. You have to, one thing about this program is every time you go in for what I call a re-up to refund it, it's almost harder. They do want to give grants to new people, but when you have an exemplary program and you have a great grant, you can be refunded. And they have been refunded basically four times. And that's quite a compliment. And, of course, Susan has been with the program for quite a while. Susan, have you been there since 2011?
Yes, I have been.
Mm-hmm. So you've been there through this whole... So we could put this all on Susan because she's done a great job. So Susan, could you tell us a little bit about your program. Of course, you're a WIB, Workforce Investment Board, and you're going right into this program. So I'm going to turn it over to you, if that's all right with you, and let you go with it.
Okay, thanks so much, Mike and Heather and Bruce. Yeah, there's so much to say about our program that I know we only have about 15 minutes, so just stop me when we've heard enough, because there is so much to say, and we are on our fourth grant right now, and really our fifth if we count the one that was done in 2004. But I think that you had a good point that maybe we should step back a little first and look at, just to make sure everybody understands, what is the Workforce Investment Board? What do we primarily do? Because our biggest job really is to be a policy and planning organization, public agency, and to oversee the Career Center. And that's what the Workforce Investments Boards do throughout the country. But what we feel is that, you know, as we're doing policy and planning in the workforce arena and overseeing the Career Center, we're understanding that job seekers may have additional needs that our Career Center cannot meet, and that our employers as well. You know, our Career Center provides tremendous services for job seekers, helping them explore careers, do resumes and things like that, and do a job search and connect with employment. But they can't do everything. So we also look at the fact that the Workforce Investment Board can design its own programs and operate its own programs and seek funding for them, for the things that maybe the Career Center can't focus as much on as is really needed. So that's why a Workforce Investment Board might get into this arena. And, you know, it's true. Mike was talking about the advantages that a public agency has in going into the EPA program. And it's true that our WIB is probably a medium-sized WIB, and we manage anywhere from $6 to $8 million a year. You know, some might think we're a big agency. Others might think that we're a tiny agency. But it does mean that we have a lot of fiscal experience, so that we have that fiscal staff. You know, we understand how to manage a federal grant, and that makes it easier for us. And we also have so many different funding streams that if there's a part, such as the soft skills, that is not funded through EPA or the overhead, that's okay. We can cover that with other funding streams. And also, it's true, Mike was talking about working with the Career Center. We can leverage all that they have to offer. So most of the time we do ask them to do a lot of our soft skills training, and we try to actually just integrate into their schedule of workshops for things like resumes, interview skills, and things like that, because it's good that people understand the services of the Career Center. So even when they're out of training, they may be able to go ahead and use the Career Center. So another issue about that Mike was talking about is, how would other agencies, let's say a small nonprofit organization, work with its Workforce Investment Board on one of these environmental workforce development and job training grants? You know, you could approach your Workforce Investment Board if they were applying and see if they need help with specific tasks like being a recruiter, recruiting from the community, potentially training skills, providing the training. Job placement as well, if you're an agency that has a lot of connection with employers. And then, again, potentially being the soft skill provider, because the EPA funds wouldn't support that, but the WIB may have other funds. And as well, you might want to work with the Career Center or the Workforce Investment Board, if you were thinking of applying on your own, to have them provide any of those services where it might not be your strength as well. So that's just a little background about working with the Workforce Investment Boards. And now I'll say a little bit about our program so that it can kind of help people see how we've built this over the years. And as Mike mentioned, this is in our recent last 8 years, this is our fourth grant. And our first grant we called Training for Sustainability, and I would say that that was a learning experience for us. And a lot of times HMTRI and EPA have talked about how the first grant is just that, a learning experience. we were so excited about the first one. It was a 12-week program. We trained 45 people. We trained in three different occupational skills areas. It was sustainable landscaping, deconstruction, and recycling, deconstruction, and recycling. I'm not sure if I said all three of them or not. But at any rate, what we found was the training was a little long for people. We forgot to think about the fact that, you know, people need to go to work at the same time. And we looked at the fact that our curriculum was not always the right level for our job seekers. So it was a learning experience. And then our second and third trainings were for environmental remediation workers, where our trainees received all kinds of credentials in asbestos, LES, HAZWOPER, OSHA 10, and they went out and they were really environmental remediation workers. And then our fourth time around, we looked at the state of the economy, where we saw that in our region, we had very low unemployment, and yet so much of our community was still in poverty. And we said, what's going on here? Low unemployment. And you know, what we saw really is that people were working, and there was a real need. There was still a high demand for the hazmat workers, entry level, but there was an even greater demand for what we call the second-rung jobs. And we thought, let's go ahead and work to get them people into those second-run environmental jobs, because with this unemployment, low unemployment rate, the people were finding their way into the first-rung jobs. And people who had more skills, let's say the work readiness skills already, they were working, they were underemployed, they were not making a living wage, but they needed to move up. So that's why we designed a program where we would be helping people to get their CDLB license, so their truck driving license to drive box trucks, because there was such a strong demand for that, really in the areas of environmental remediation on actual job sites, driving the tanker trucks and the hazmat trucks, and also in refuse and recyclable materials collectors, really people to be driving garbage trucks, all the kinds of trucks that are needed for solid waste management. And then there was also a really big demand in wastewater management, wastewater, stormwater work with departments of public works, and also with contractors who work with Department of Public Works. So this last program, that's the area that we have really focused on. And it's been an excellent program. And I think that a lot of the work that we've done over the years, advertising our program in the community, has really helped for people to kind of know what we're doing and be alert to when new programs are offered. So that's kind of the work. I guess it's good to know that really the first work to do is your labor market oversight work. Look and see, who are your job seekers? In this case, we were now really ready with people who had those soft skills and that were underemployed who needed to move up. That wasn't always the case for us. For a long time, we were helping people get into really the very entry-level skills in environmental remediation. And so looking at your job seeker, but also looking at your employers, what are the occupations that they really need to hire on, and who's available for those. So now we saw there was this tremendous need for truck drivers. So now let me say a little bit about our program itself. The recruiting and the screening, you know, I always encourage people to just go outside of the box on your recruiting, because thinking that just putting up flyers and people are going to show up is just not going to happen. You know, it's so important to be out at, and every community is different. For us, it's going to community events. It's being on the radio here. We have a lot of local radio programs. It's just talking to people in churches and, you know, wherever people congregate, getting the word out about specific trainings that are available. And then if they're good trainings, it'll go by word of mouth. And then we always have an orientation where we kind of weed people out to make sure that this is really something they want to do, that this is their career interest. Then we have an interview with each individual and make sure that this is really goes along with their ideas for the future. And do they really qualify for the program? Because, for example, for the this particular program with the CDLB, it's important that a person has a good driving record, that they have a driver's license, of course, and that they're able to pass the CDL permit test, which is a written test, as well as all the other eligibility that's required for an EPA grant. And then, you know, the last thing we do in recruiting and screening is we have a tryout day. And this has been very successful in our CDL program because a lot of times we'll get, 20 or 30 people who are interested. And we bring them for the day where we do all kinds of activities and have people do a little bit of public speaking about why they want to do this. And we do this with our training provider. And then the people who are selected really feel committed because they feel like that they were selected out of a large group. So our particular training is this time we're training 32 people over in four different cohorts. We work with the Teamsters Local 25 here as our driving school. And we work with another local training provider, Lawrence Training School, to provide HazWhopper. And so far we've had two cohorts have graduated so far. And what we find is there are jobs immediately. A lot of times they're going straight into Teamster jobs because those are available. We've had a few people hired by the different DPWs. And a few people who have been hired by different hauling contractors as well. So there's certainly a demand. Let's see. I don't know how much more time we have here, Mike. We could talk a little bit about what things have been, difficulties and lessons learned, if there's still time. What do you think?
I think a little bit about some of the problems you've come across. And, you've done something really exactly right. We're in the preliminary stages before these RFPs come out, and this is the time when the most important thing you do is what you just talked about. Look at your labor market and sit back. It's one of those sit back types of things. Where is the labor market going? And so you do your labor market assessment and you do your community assessment, and what kind of people am I dealing with that I could train and be successful. It doesn't help to train people who cannot be successful. And I think you've nailed it. And I can see why you all have been successful. You're not just going 1, 2, 3, responding to, okay, I've got to do this, this, and this, and I'm going to teach them and they will come. And that's not how it works at this point. What about some of the problems? And I'd like to see if anyone has some other questions. What would you say has been the big problem that you've had?
Well, I think that one thing is make sure that you don't overpromise. You know how I have just been talking a lot about how everyone's been placed, and that's been a great thing, and people have jobs. But, you can't start off at the start saying, we promise you a job. Because, really what we try to do is what we call a warm handoff. We know the employers, and we know our graduates. So we do everything in our power to bring the two together and to recommend people for specific jobs. However, we cannot make an employer hire someone, and we also can't make a graduate, maybe it's not the person we thought they were, maybe they're not as committed or they have other issues so that they don't do the work necessary to be ready to go to work. So don't overpromise at the start saying that, it's just a tremendous, finish that they will 100% positively arrive at. So that's one thing. And another thing is think through how people will overcome barriers. Like I said, our first training was 12 weeks long, and I think that we thought when we designed that program more about how great the training was and how exciting the training was And we forgot to think about, you know, wait a minute, how can people do an 8 to 4 training every day for 12 weeks without going to work? How many people can do that? So think through the barriers. Most people have to work. Some may be on unemployment insurance, but not all of them. Think about the kinds of jobs that you're looking for people to get and transportation. Is there a good match between the community and the specific people that you are targeting and where the jobs are? For example, a lot of times for us, placing people in environmental remediation worker jobs, well, if they didn't have transportation, we have a lot of responsible temp agencies in Lawrence, so therefore they could get to the job. But so that was really important. And maybe potentially childcare could be an issue. So it's important to ask up front, you know, how are people going to take care of themselves during the training to make sure that they're supported? And will they have, you know, the transportation once they've graduated? You know, another thing that we have found is it's so important to not just provide training and workshops, but also to mentor individuals. Because a lot of times, coaching and building self-esteem are what people need to really be able to, at the end of the day, have the confidence to get and keep a job. So that's another issue as well.
One thing that
we're going through right now that's a big difficulty is that we have lost our program manager, who he has moved on to another opportunity. So we are just doing a search for a new one. So that's been challenging as well.
Matthias was great, and we all loved him and are happy he's finding another position in a different field. One of the questions I was going to ask was, are you running into a problem with drug? Or you, I assume the WIB screens everybody before they come into the program?
Yes, the thing is that the Teamsters do screen them day one, and they also do random drug testing, because to be a truck driver, you will run into random drug screenings, and it can be an issue. It's something that we bring up all along the way, and people who believe that they're going to have a problem, either they self-select out, or they might do a lot of things to try to clean up their system before the test. But that is definitely an issue. However, again, in this job market where we have a lot of people who are, the unemployment rate is so low, yet people are still living in poverty. People are used to going to work every day. They want to move up. So they are doing what needs to be done to, you know, be eligible for this program.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Massachusetts, of course, now marijuana is legal. So that's another whole issue, because to be a truck driver, you have to be free of marijuana as well. And it's not really clear how that's going to go yet.
Right. That's going to be an issue. One big question I have, and anyone else who has questions like that, have them ask. If you're a WIB, you decide you want to apply for this grant. When it comes RFP, it comes out. What if you're not a WIB and you're one of these other groups, whether it's entrepreneurial or you're combining with another group, or say whatever the case is, how do you approach the WIB? I mean, how do you engage the WIB in your program and get them into your partnership somehow?
You know, first I think you have to know what kind of WIB is in your area, because do you have a WIB that does programming so that the actual work that the WIB does in your area, would it be something that you'd want to have be part of your program? You know, if the answer is yes, then look at what their programming is to think about how you could collaborate with them. But the WIB could definitely help. All WIBs could help with the LMI, the labor market information, and also with the industry employers. So that's two things you could look at the WIB for. And then secondly, you should also look at the WIB to help connect with your career center, because the career center does provide all of the job seeker skills training, career counseling. Again, that would be a collaboration where a nonprofit may be in charge of the trainees, in charge of the training, and then would send the trainees to the career center for those soft skills, and that would be paid for just under the Career Center's own funding.
Right. So what you want to do probably, or you could correct me, is in your locality, and every WIB, you're right, every WIB is different.
Yeah.
And there are stars and there are rocks. But you want to go to the WIB or Google the WIB in your area and try to find someone in the WIB organization who will probably direct you to some one-stops. But you really, your first stop is probably that WIB, don't you think?
Right, I do think so. And then that's the thing that if they do, they can definitely provide you with the labor market information, because sometimes that can be hard to find, you know, looking all over websites to try to understand what are the priority industries in your area, and also looking up the census information about your community. They could help with that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
As you prepare your application and as you think of what occupations are the ones that you would like to focus on. But then it will probably be the Career Center that you would partner with for the soft skill part of the training.
Gotcha.
And I should mention as well, potentially with job placement, because they do have business service representatives who work directly with employers, and they may have ones in the field. They're working with employers who are in the field that the program would be targeting.
Gotcha. Anyone have any questions or inquiries? Susan, while we have her. Susan, one thing, I really liked your presentation at our all grantee meeting, and would it be all right if we pop that onto the notes, the PowerPoint that you put up?
Absolutely, and I think you've got two PowerPoints there, one that Matthias did on our program, and then one that I did that I think was on, I think, fundraising.
There was one on hiring barriers and about your organization, some of your partners that I think had your name on it. I'll double check them. Yes, that was really good.
Probably both of them would be useful. Mm-hmm.
Good, good. We'll put those on the notes. If it's all right. And also, if it's all right, if someone has wants to talk to you individually or email you, or is
Absolutely.
It all right if I put your contact information?
Yes, that would be
great. Okay, anyone on the call or listening to this or get notes, if you want to talk to Susan, she's been there, done that, and obviously done it right. So
and
we
I
appreciate
know that these conversations, before we applied the first time, I listened to every single one for probably 6 months. So it's very useful.
Well, it's 30 minutes. Unfortunately, it's kind of like the psychologist. Well, our time's up. So until 2 weeks from now. I hope everyone has a good couple of weeks. So thank you
so
again. Thank you.
Okay.
Everyone
thank
have
you.
A good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.